Okay, so I'll be discussing about some configuration. I mean, at first instance, the two subjects seem to be quite unrelated, but as you'll see, they have quite a lot to do with each other. And again, I welcome as many questions as possible. This is some subject which, I mean, some things are unclear. So the more we can clarify things, the more we can understand things, the better. So that's the title of the talk. And it's based on two papers, one which I had with Per Kraus in February, and one which I wrote in April. And there's also some work in progress with Don and Radu and Belkis and Henriette. So there's quite a lot of main people here have been working on this quite actively. So I'll first review what supertubes are. I guess, I mean, I don't know how many people are familiar with them, but I'll just review their physics. I'll do a lightning review of the D195 system, maybe with P. And I'll mention the proposal which Samir Mathur had about explaining the entropy of the D195 system by counting geometries. And I'll use this as motivation for looking for those three-charge supertubes. I'll describe them using the Born-Imfeld action of some brains. In our paper with Per Kraus, there's another description, but I'll just skip it. It's just technically, I mean, it's not very enlightening. I'll discuss the relation of those tubes to the three-charge black holes. And then, so that's the, up to here is work which I have done with Per Kraus. And then I'll discuss how one can obtain the near tube geometry of those supertubes and what are its properties and the fact that this appears to be evidence that there are some BPS black rings which have the same features as the supertubes. So I'll discuss those. Again, I mean, this is in this limit, I'll just be discussing the flat tubes. So it's not possible to prove that the black rings do exist because maybe curvature effects mess things up. But it's quite, as I'll argue, it's quite likely. And then I'll talk about some future directions. So first, I'll just give you a brief review of the two-charge supertubes. I will not tell you how I derive my claims. I will explain that later when I describe the full supertubes. So those are just some features which have been discussed in the literature for maybe like the past 3 years or 4 years since supertubes first appeared. I'll explain like in a few slides. Actually, I'll back all my claims with real calculations. But for now, I'll just briefly outline their features. First of all, you can take D0 brains and F1 strings, give them some angular momentum, and they actually can pop out into this D2 brain, which is spinning. And at the beginning, you might say, gosh, I mean, this configuration is not going to be BPS unless, I mean, there's no way for this thing to be BPS because, I mean, you have D brain charge on this side with one sign, on the other side with the other sign, and everybody who read Joe's book knows that two D brains of opposite orientations cannot be BPS. Well, it turns out that those supertubes are BPS. They actually preserve 8 supercharges, which is quite a lot. The way this happens is that the electric field on the D2 brain is critical, and because of that, I mean, so when you have, for example, a D1 string and the electric string is critical, then the mass of the D1 string goes away. Here, the same thing happens. The electric field being critical basically throws away the D brain, the D2 brain from the equations of motion and from the supersymmetry variations. So because of that, the D2 brain basically doesn't have any effect on the supersymmetry equations. And the supertubes preserve the same supercharges as their components. So this is going to be one of my main slogans this talk, so remember it. Basically, the fact that when you make a supertube out of some components, the supertubes have the same supercharges as preserve the same supersymmetries as their components. Now, the cross-section of the tube does not need to be S1. Those are some papers by Townsend and Mateos and Serena Ng, which actually consider the general embedding of this curve in some of this tube in some transverse R4. Again, this direction needs to be flat, but this S1 does not need to be S1. It can be any closed curve in some transverse space. And actually, it's possible to show, and I'll actually show you that any configuration of the tube, even like the most wiggly type of configuration, which I can just give you this configuration, and automatically, knowing that it is a supertube, I can say that it has its BPS. It has 8 supercharges, the same as the D0 and the F1 supercharges, and its energy is equal to the sum of the energies of the D0 of its component brains. Again, one string and zero brain. The D2 brain charge does not, the D2 brain dipole charge does not enter either in the BPS conditions or in the either in the BPS or in the supersymmetry. So it's completely goes out of the story.
And
the curves can intersect itself. I don't think people wrote solutions for where it really intersects. I mean, this curve can be any curve in R4. So you have a transverse R4 and you have a one-dimensional curve. So generically, I mean, on the modular space of such curves, then self-intersections are rare. So, I mean, I don't think people know how to write the full intersection. I mean, there's no, I don't think it's known. So if you dualize the supercube, you take these zeros and ones, and you have a D2 dipole moment, you can T-dualize four times, make a D4, F1, D6. You can do a 9-11 flip. I mean, let's see what you can do. If you T-dualize only once this, and then you S-dualize, you can probably, you can actually get to this configuration where you have a D0 and a D4 with angular momentum popping out into an NS5. So that's another supertube configuration. And if you T-dualize this transverse to the NS5, you actually get the D1, D5 popping out into a Kaluza-Klein monopole in type 2B. And you can also write this in some other, I mean, if you T-dualize this, you can actually get it to be, and then S-dualize, you can actually get this to be an FP string, so a fundamental string carrying some momentum, which has a certain wave on it. So all those are the same. All those are the same animal. It's just, I mean, it's just in different duality frames. And I'm just running them by you so that you, they don't. So I mean, they actually have the same. They actually have the same physics. And here, for example, it's obvious why you have the same why you have 16 supercharges. When you have the FP string, you can put any profile. As long as you have only right-moving excitations, you can put any profile on this FP string, and you still have 16 supercharges. So the fact that any profile in that FP string, as long as it's right moving, gives you 16 supercharges, translates to the fact that any shape of these supertubes also have 16, also have, I'm sorry, 8 supercharges here, not 16 because it's FP. So Mathur and Lunin and Saxena and Srivastava, I think, they actually found, they have been working on a certain program for about, I don't know, maybe 5 years or 4 years, where actually they have been trying to map the geometries of the microstates of the D1, D5 system into configurations which contain, into geometries which contain D1, D5s polarized into Kaluza-Klein monopoles. They actually have the metric for those configurations, and the metrics just come from dualizing the FP system. So they have this correspondence in which each microstate of the D1, so the D1 D5 system has a certain entropy. Each microstate of this D1 D5 system corresponds to one geometry. So this, their picture can be summarized as just one geometry per microstate. That's their main thrust, and the different shapes on which the this Kaluza-Klein monopole curve is wrapped basically correspond to different microstates in the dual D1 D5 system. So again, these D1 D5 strings, they form a Kaluza-Klein monopole tube, and as I told you, any shape of this tube is BPS, has 8 supercharges. So each of those shapes basically corresponds to one of the microstates of the D1 D5 of the D1 D5 system. Now, the $1,000 question is, can we extend this picture about the microstates of the D1 D5P system? So in the D1 D5 system, we know that basically we have a certain entropy which is of the order of square root and 1 and 5, but there's no real black hole there. I mean, there's no, that entropy just corresponds to a stretched horizon, and there's not, I mean, we don't have a real black hole in that system. On the other hand, in the D1 D5P system, we do have a black hole which has a macroscopic, which has a large size horizon. So I mean, it's a nice object. And if we could somehow extend this question, extend this picture to the D1 D5P system, then we'd prove that basically each microstate of the D1 D5P system corresponds to one geometry. And I think that would be very interesting for our understanding of black holes. Here I'm using some words which are not so so clear, but somehow, I mean, if you think about the boundary theory, you have those microstates, their entropy gives you the you can count their entropy, and you can match the entropy to the one of the black hole. So you should be able to think about the black hole as the statistical average, roughly speaking, of these geometries. So basically, you have in the bulk, you have many, many geometries, a huge number of them. And somehow the black hole comes from just superposing them on top of each other. So Matur has like this picture in which basically the black hole has all this geometry superposed on each other, and then if this picture is right, for example, you can solve the information paradox in, it solves a lot of puzzles which people have about black holes. Again, it's not very clear what I mean by statistical average. I don't have the right understanding of this, and I mean any input would be more than welcome. But somehow we know in the CFT that you have one microstate per geometry. You know that the black hole is the statistical average of the microstates. So in the same way, in the bulk, if the ADS CFT duality holds, which hopefully it does, then you know that basically this black hole can be thought as the statistical average of those microstates. Now, there are a few points which Matur makes, and which those microstates, those regular geometries are called the hair of this black hole in this, that's how Matur calls them. They are not what usually people mean by black hole hair. Now, those geometries must be at infinity very similar to each other. After all, they have the same charges as the black hole. It's only when you come very close to their center that they actually start differing from each other. And according to Matur's picture, they should start differing from each other around the point where the horizon of the black hole is. So basically, outside of the horizon, all the geometries are the same. You just superpose them in some yet to be defined way, and you can just throw a particle there, and nothing happens. When you get inside this region where the geometries are different from each other, and you throw some particle, you can think about the particle as decohering to these many geometries, and then never coming back. So that's the equivalent of black hole absorption in that picture. So one thing which can immediately kill Matur's proposal is, for example, if those microstates have on average radius which is much bigger than the radius of the black hole, then you can actually rule it out. So there are some very sharp predictions which this proposal makes, so in the D1D5P system, they are that basically you have microstates of the D1D5P system which have the same charges as the black hole. Those are going to be regular geometries. On one hand, they have no entropy of themselves, and they have the same size, approximately speaking, as the size of the circumference of the black hole horizon, and if you count those geometries in some fashion, you actually should be able to reproduce the black hole entropy. So those are very precise proposals which Matur makes, and I think it's interesting. I mean, it's interesting to try to see if it's right or not. I mean, what can happen? I mean, if it doesn't work, we can kill it, and so on. If it works, then I mean, we will be famous. So there's nothing to lose. Right now, the only tools we have to build those geometries are actually using those supertubes, which I'll construct, in an instant. So right now, the only place where we have any control is when we have some supersymmetry. So those are the D1D5 free system, and maybe the four-charge black hole in four dimensions. But so that's the only place where we can make any arguments. There is like this heuristic formula. I don't know if Matur talked about it. Basically, the fact that the entropy of a non-extremal black hole can be written as square root of n1 plus n1 bar np times n plus np bar. So I mean, this is like this heuristic formula which people found a while ago, and it wasn't very well accepted by the mainstream, according to my knowledge. I mean, it's not a very, I mean, it just happens to be like that. So Matur's picture actually, if this happens, I mean, if his picture is confirmed for non-extremal black holes, I mean, it's quite a possibility that it will happen for all the black holes. For extremal black holes, it's quite a possibility that it will happen for all the black holes. I mean, I can take it a bit away from extremality and so on. But I mean, right now, the only thing, I mean, first things first, I mean, we need to check if it's true for extremal black holes. If it's true for those, then I mean, I don't know. I'll probably bet it's true also for non-extremal black holes. But again, I mean, it's a bet. It's not. I'll not have any proof. But if it's not, I mean, if it dies here, then I mean, it's just going to be dead. So we'll have to come back to our old way of thinking. So there are some immediate questions which must be addressed. First of all, one needs to construct those geometries. I mean, you basically need to give me a huge number of geometries which have the same as the asymptotics as the black hole, and they must have size of the order of the horizon of the black hole. If their size is much bigger, again, this thing is out of the question. A good thing to do, which I think it can be done, and a few.
By geometry, you mean solutions of the classical equation?
Yes, solutions of supergravity equation of motion. You wouldn't think they exist, wouldn't you? They're very hard. I mean, those supertubes have the deep brain physics of the supertubes is very interesting, and it actually allows for those geometries to exist. I mean, it's very non. It's not one of the things which you would expect. I mean, if somebody told you a few years ago that, gosh, I'll come and find zillions of geometries which have the same asymptotics far away, yet as you come near the center, they will actually have some deep brain of a certain on a certain shape. And everything is going to be VPS also. I mean, it's hard to.
But if this is supposed to apply to everything, don't we know in some cases that that's not the case for sure?
I think.
Those are not going to be spherically symmetric geometries. Right. None of those guys is spherically symmetric. Right. So.
We don't know that there aren't.
We don't know that there are a large number.
Arbitrary.
M gets bigger and bigger. M's a bigger. Mm-hmm. M gets bigger and bigger, right?
So arbitrary. Large number.
You need to be an arbitrary large number.
You get the M.
But in four dimensions, these are all that by the mirror is there.
By what?
There's a theorem in four dimensions using the mirror image which says that there are no non trivial solutions that are stationary, asymptotically flat, just to say
Mm-hmm. Actually, let me make a comment. Those supertubes only exist in string theory. They only exist if you assume that you have Welzumino terms in the action. It's not any type. I mean, if you just put gravity and some Maxwell fields and just couple them normally, those things are not going to exist. So the existence of those supertubes is fundamentally linked to the fact that you have a Welzumino term in the action. If that term is gone, you have no supersymmetry, and you have none of those supertubes.
Yeah, so, I understand, but there's a philosophy more general.
Yes.
Strange if it applied to some black holes and not other black.
String theory is a theory of gravity. We know it holds. So as a theory of, I mean, the black holes which appear in string theory, those probably should be able to be made of supertubes. I mean, that's so my feeling right now is string theory. I mean, the black holes which you can construct, which you can realize as black holes of string theory, those should be able to like just construct with those D-brains. And put, of course, I mean, again, at infinity, I mean, so if you just take four-dimensional pure gravity, maybe there's a theorem, but I mean there are some modes which you basically don't.
The theorem doesn't work with transformations.
Yes, and it doesn't work probably with. You have many Maxwell fields and forms, and I mean it's so the four-dimensional theory is not going to be just the pure gravity.
So you relativists would be
uncomfortable
with the notion
that it might exist arbitrarily. I just think this is totally crazy. Okay, I didn't think this had a chance. Then they found all of these solutions for the D1, D5 system, which I would have bet worked there.
Mm-hmm.
They were all non-singular, there's a huge number of solutions. So, you know, I still think it's a long shot. I think it's a long shot, but I can't say we know it's not true for the D1, D5, and P system. And then when you say, well, what about neutral black holes? There's this argument that if you can get arbitrary, sort of VPS things, then maybe you can get neutral things by having, either the VPS try to superpose things of opposite charges in some sort of some way, mm-hmm. Different charges to cancel out, to keep the geometry locally regular and things like that. So I don't know. I mean, it mm-hmm. seems. Certainly it would be a major change in time. I've always thought about black holes. But it's worth looking for.
So okay, so I mean, what we'll find here is actually, I mean, we'll just construct some of the three charge supertubes, and I'll show that. I mean, basically, I'll show that the deep brain physics behind the fact that you have all these many mature solutions is actually the same as the deep brain physics behind the fact that there is a huge number of three charge solutions also present. Now, so the question right now is actually not that you have many solutions. The question is how many, and it's actually a matter of counting right now. I think, I mean, we know. I mean, as I'll show you, we'll have many solutions. I mean, just zillions of them. It's just the question is like, if you count them, do you get the right black hole entropy, or do you get just a subset? So, I mean, that's the main. That's the main question right now. So let's try to make those three-charge supertubes. What do I need to do to make a three-charge supertube? As I showed you on a previous slide, I can make a supertube from D0, F1, going into a D2 brain. So you can have D0 brains, F1 brains, which pop out into a D2 brain supertube, or D1, or D4, F1 into a D6, or D0, D4 into an NS5. So I wrote this schematically, D0, F1 into a D2, D6, and NS5. So you think a three-charge supertube would have D0, F1, and D4, and all the three charges which dipole charges which normal supertubes have. So how would those look? You have a D0 brain, which is just in a time direction. You have a D4 brain on four torus. You have an F1 transverse to the D4 brain. If you titulize those guys along the F1, you get a D1, D5P system. So the F1 becomes P, D1, D0 becomes D1, D4 becomes D5. So this is exactly the D1, D5P system in type 2A. I work in type 2A because the brains in type 2A are different. If you go to type 2B, the D2 and the D0 become the same D1 at a tilt. So those supertubes in type 2B, they look like some swiggly helices in some geometry, in some Kaluza-Klein geometry. So I don't like that too much. I'd much rather work with clean cut D brains where I can use the Born infeld action. And I mean, I think it's a much more clean, the picture in type 2A is much cleaner. So I have a D2 brain dipole moment, which is basically comes from the F1s and the D0s. So it's extended in the theta direction, which is the direction of the tube, and also along the one direction. There's a D6 brain, which also has the four torus on top of that. And there's an NS5 brain, which basically has is on the torus and in the theta direction. So the old supertubes are just D0, D4 into NS5, D0, F1 into D2, and F1, D4 into D6. Now, how can one describe those tubes? The most obvious way is just describe them the way the usual supertubes are described. Just take the D6 brain-born infeld action and write down all the lower charges. Write down F1 charge, D4 charge, D2 charge, and D0 charge. And just find if the thing can have any radius, and if the thing is BPS. And I mean, just find what it does. Another way to do it is actually to write the non-abelian born infeld action of the D4 brains. Take a stack of D4 brains, spread them on a line, write some non-abelian ansatz for their matrices, and also count and also find if the configuration is BPS. We also did that in the paper. I'll not discuss it here. The problem with this description is that the NS5 brain charge cannot be captured by the Born infeld action. I actually tried. I mean, we actually spent quite a bit of a time trying to see if the NS5 brain charge, if we can describe, for example, then, I mean, you see the NS5 charge in principle is dissolved into the D6 in some way. The D6 has an extra component, but somehow the D6 Born infeld action cannot capture that. I mean, it's from the Born infeld point of view, it's a non-perturbative phenomenon. So the tubes which we construct are going to have no NS5 charge for now. As I'll show in the second part of the talk, I'll have some solutions which do have those charges. So I have some gravity solutions which actually have all the three charges. But in the Born infeld action, it's not possible to describe tubes which have all the three dipole charges. Another comment, you can think, OK, let's dualize the NS5 charge away. Let's go to some duality frame when there is no NS5 charge and just have D-brains. Well, that's also very hard to do. Actually, you can try to dualize this as many ways as possible. You always get to some, you'll always have some configuration which has an NS5 charge. So
when you say NS5 charge, you mean really dipole?
Dipole moment, yes. Yes. No, of course. So all the green guys are dipole moments. They are in the theta direction, so they are extended in this tube direction. So I'll construct some tubes which have D2 and D6 dipole moments. They can be now three charge system can be u-dualized into itself by changing the labelings. So for example, I can dualize this into F1, D0, D4, or any way I want. So I can interchange the three charges any way I want. So in the same way, I can dualize my tubes into any two charge tubes, into any two dipole charge tubes. So as you'll see, I mean, we'll have those. So those tubes are going to be here. And now I also know, I mean, it's part of my construction, that those tubes are going to be mutually BPS, and they are going to have the same supersymmetry as the brains which make them. So this tube and this tube are going to be mutually BPS. So the three charge tubes will exist by just putting those tubes on top of each other. And I mean, that's the intuition. But again, I have no Born infeld description of it. So before, I mean, I shouldn't I shouldn't advertise before constructing. So let's take a D6 brain, make it, give it a circular, give it a size of the form S1 cross some R5, and let's put some fluxes on it to see what's happening. So we put fundamental string charge by turning on some electric field, F01. We put a D4 brain charge by turning on an F1 theta. Once again, I think I should give you the geometry just to make things easier. So I need to put fundamental string charge, so I turn on F01. And the D4 brain is basically induced by turning on magnetic field F1 theta. I turn on an F23 wedge F45 on the torus. This gives me, so if I just have a D4 brain on a torus and I turn those fluxes, I get a D0 brain charge on it. So if I turn on those things from the D6 brain point of view, I'll get a D2 brain charge, a D2 brain dipole moment, sorry. And then I also get D0 charge from just the wedge of those three guys. So I just have a D6 brain with those fields, and I can count, the D brain charges and dipole moments are just given by, the D brains are just given by those things. The fundamental string charge is a bit more complicated, as I'll show. And let's find the action. Well, the action is actually very simple to find. Those fluxes only, you'll basically have a non-trivial matrix in the 0, 1, and theta components. And basically, the Born-Info action is just going to be 1 minus F01 times G theta theta plus F1 theta squared. That's from the 0, 1 theta chunk of the induced of the Born-Infeld action.
Your background metric is flat.
Yes, the background metric is flat. Yes, so this is just a D-brain calculation in flat space. I just have some D-brains. I just have flat space. G theta theta gives me the embedding of this D-brain in flat space. So, I can embed it in any way I want. That's why I keep it. If it's a sphere, then this is just going to be R squared, but I just keep it as a number. And this is actually going to be the chunk which gives me the... This is the Born-Infeld action on the four torus. So basically on the four torus I have this product of the field strength. When I only have two charges, so when I only have, for example, if I turn this off, F23 and F45, I'll just get a pure D6 F1 D4 supertube, which is the same as the one Matthäus and Townsend did 4 years ago. So this chunk of the action is just the old supertube action, and this is the new three charge part. Now the fundamental string charge is just the derivative of the action with respect to F01. So it's going to be equal to F01 times G theta theta over this square root times this guy. Now, one can actually find the Hamiltonian of this configuration. That's the usually way. You just find the Hamiltonian of this thing and you minimize and you find the radius. But there's an observation which you can make beforehand, which is that if you choose F01 to be 1, I just arbitrarily choose, I just want to look at the configuration which has F01 equals 1, and I also choose F23 to be equal to F45, then automatically the Hamiltonian of this configuration, so if F01 is 1, this cancels, and basically the Hamiltonian is going to be Q1 times F01 minus the Lagrangian. And this suggests just the fundamental, that's just the fundamental string charge times F01. So automatically this is going to give me Q1 plus F1 theta. Oh, and also I also choose F23 equals F45. So this is going to give me Q01 plus the integral of F1 theta times this product. And as you can see, this is exactly going to give me Q1 plus Q4 plus Q0. So the energy of this D6 brain is actually going to be the same as the energy of its component brains, of the brains which make the supertube, so which are the F1, the D0, and the D4. So, and I can actually show that you can also show that the thing is BPS, so it has the same supersymmetry as the components. So basically, any solution which I choose, which has a critical electric field and has equal fluxes on the four torus, gives me an energy configuration which saturates the BPS bound. Now, so the nice part is that this is BPS independent of what G theta theta is. So any embedding of this curve which I choose in a transverse R4, any shape you want, as long as it's smooth, hopefully, and closed, is going to give me a solution which is going to be BPS and is going to preserve four superchargers like the component brains preserve. That's exactly the same as so the two-charge supercube, the mature solutions have two charges, and they have a random curve in some R4, and they have eight supercharges like the one that like the D95 system has, and again it's embedding independent. Here the same thing happens. It's just that you have this extra torus directions, and basically, again, the Hamiltonian is just going to be equal to the sum of the charges, and it's completely independent on how you want to embed this tube in the transverse R4. So those geometries exist, and quite a...
You're saying that you have just as many three-charge supertubes?
At least just as many. At least just as many, because I also have... So those are three-charge supertubes which have two dipole charges. Now, I can also T-dualize them. I can also U-dualize them into into supertubes which have the other two dipole charges. So I can get at least three times more. And now the other super tubes to have are the ones which have three dipole charges, and those I don't know how many I have. So actually, I mean, so there are going to be quite a few novel configurations of those tubes. I mean, I mean, again, it's something which needs to be done. But at least as many as Mature has, I can have, because I mean, actually, if you add the third charge, I just do it by adding this extra chunk, and everything just works. So any curve which gives me a two-charge supertubes in Mature solution should give me a solution in this case.
Sorry, you keep saying Mature, but I mean, this is what Townsend, this is the analog of what Townsend.
This is the analog of what Townsend. Townsend and Mature did exactly the same thing. It's just that Mature did it for the F1P system and dualized it to D1D5, and Townsend did it for the D0F1 into D2 and dualized it, and he didn't dualize it at all. He just caused them supertubes. But they're exactly the same. It's exactly the same physics. It's exactly the same system. They just worked independently. I mean, they had different motivations.
Okay,
and
I guess I'll say the difference.
Yes.
But they later found the supergravity solution.
Yes. So, well, I mean, I don't have the full super. So, as I'll show you, I don't have the full supergravity solution of those three charges. And I'll actually show you why those three charge solutions are difficult to find. There are a few supergravity solutions on the market. One is by Lunin, the other one is by Mathur and his students. And what I'll find actually is going to be the supergravity solution near this tube. So if you assume to have a large tube, I actually have a way to find the supergravity solutions near this tube, and I'll show you they have some pretty nice features. So I only have, but you know that you have some D-brain system, and basically in the two-charge case, the D-brain system can map one-to-one into these supergravity solutions. And so I'm pretty sure the supergravity solutions exist. It's just a matter of finding them and solving some nonlinear equations. Now, the radius of this cube, so in case I assume a circular embedding, the radius is going to be given by g string squared times q1, q4, times over q0, q4, which is actually, so q's are the charges which enter in the BPS condition. So they are, so for example, for the fundamental string, q is equal to n, but for the d-brains, q is equal to n over, to the number over g. So q is actually the mass of the d-brains, and n is the actual number of d-brains. So as you see, the radius of those tubes increases as I increase the gravitation, as I increase g-string. Now, in the usual correspondence picture, which Joe and Gary taught us, you have a d-brain system which has some finite excitations, and you can put the entropy in that system. You crank on the g-string, and the d-brain system becomes tinier and tinier. Gravity cramps it down, and the black hole forms and engulfs everything, so then you can match the entropy of the black hole with the entropy of the d-brain system if you are BPS. Those tubes have no correspondence point because the black hole horizon also increases with the same in the same way as the radius of the tubes. So those tubes don't. So when you increase the string, those tubes are not going to collapse. They're actually going to become bigger. Why this is happening is it's a very funny piece of physics. The reason is that you have a D2 brain, which is basically which has also some angular momentum. So you can think about this as supporting against collapse by some angular momentum. Now, as this thing increases, the mass of the D2 brain becomes smaller. And since the angular momentum is a charge and it's fixed, actually this thing becomes bigger. So that's the physics behind those tubes. I mean, they have some angular momentum, which basically increases. So the angular momentum is fixed, and the D2 brain mass decreases. So actually the radius becomes bigger and bigger. So those things do become, I mean, their size grows up. The same way the charge of the Schwarzschild radius grows up. So that's a nice, I mean, that's already some, I mean, this is a point where the Mathur, I mean, if those things didn't increase with G-string, the Mathur conjecture would have been wrong. clear. I mean, those things which are just collapsed would have become some deep brain configurations, and the black hole would have taken over. But no, actually, those increase in the same way as the deep brain, in the same way as the horizon increases. So actually, that's a pretty non-trivial confirmation that they have this. So that they have these features. And again, they should describe black hole microstates in the regime where gravity is weak. So all these calculations, I mean, everything which we do should be done when where gravity is weak. So I mean those things are, so in the regime where supergravity is valid. Now, if you have more than one D6 brain, you can actually take a few D6 brains. The radius of this thing is going to be diminished by a factor of 1 over the dipole moment of the 6 brain squared. That's also because you basically put more D6 brains than you, for fixed angular momentum, this thing wants to, I mean, if there's more mass to, I mean, basically the mass wants to keep it down, to basically make it more clumpy. So there's a balance between the angular momentum of those solutions. I mean, this is very heuristic, this angular momentum argument, because I can take a tube which is like wiggly shaped that has no net angular momentum. But I mean, for a circular tube, it's easy to see why this is happening. So for circular tubes, if I put more D6 brains, basically this thing is going to be more and more crumpled up. Also, in this, as you saw in the word volume, in the word volume description, the D4 brain charge is proportional to F1 theta, the D2 brain charge is proportional to this, and the D0 brain charge is proportional to this product. And the D6 brain charge is taken to be 1. So the dipole moments and the charges must satisfy this relation. The dipole moment of the 2 brain over the dipole moment of the 6 brain must be equal to the dipole moment of the 0 brain over the dipole moment of the 4 brain. So at least the most simple supertubes that one can build, from basically made of the 4 brains, they must have this relation between the dipole moments and the charges. You cannot just put a random, you cannot just put any dipole moment you want and any charges you want. They must satisfy this relation. Now, if you think about making some supertubes from, you can also make equal radius tubes. So you can make two tubes which have the same radius and have different dipole moments. And you can think about adding them on top of each other. And then actually you can violate this relation. I'm insisting on this relation a bit too much, but as you'll see later when you construct the gravity solution, this actually is going to be prove crucial. I mean, this relation will come out in a very natural fashion, and this equality will imply the absence of closed time-like curves in those backgrounds. So it's actually quite, so this comes from the D-brain description of the supertubes, and it seems to be completely ad hoc. I mean, why should those charges be proportional to each other, ranked in this fashion? But actually, when you do the supergravity analysis of the near tube metric, this equality actually implies the absence of closed time-like curves. It actually implies that those backgrounds are actually not misbehaved. Again, as I said, those can be generalized into D2 NS5 or D6 NS5 supertubes. And again, it's quite likely that recharge tubes also exist, and they are described as bound states of two of those tubes. And so I think that's actually this is the construction. So the only things which I wanted to take away are, for example, are the fact that the angular momentum, so the fact that the radius, for example, grows like G string times approximately n squared, and as I'll show you later, the angular momentum is also goes like n squared. I mean, I'll come back to that in a second. In the paper with Per Kraus, we also constructed the tubes from a non-abelian Born-Infeld action of the D4 brains. It wasn't too much of a non-abelian Born-Infeld action calculation because all the field strengths we had were diagonal, so none of the symmetrized trace prescription problems entered in our calculation. Just, I mean, all, after doing the action, all the field strengths were diagonal, so it was just a diagonal action. The symmetrized trace prescription didn't enter at all in our calculation. And again, we got the same result. So now I'll switch a tiny bit gear. So what I want to do is actually to compare those tubes, the tubes that we built, with the three charged black holes, and to see actually again if their sizes match, and I mean how they get along with each other. One thing which I want to make, again, I want to emphasize, those tubes have the same supersymmetry as their components. So if you take a three-charged black hole, or if you take a supertube with those three charges, or if you have any of the three charges, everything is mutually BPS. So the masses are always going to be equal to the sum of the charges, so those tubes, regardless of what shape the tube have. So I mean, that's a very important feature of those configurations. Now, let's do a brief review of the D95P system. I mean, it's probably familiar to everybody, but I'll just do it for to get some to get people up to. I mean, it's probably hard to remember sometimes. So in the D95P system, you have left-moving fermions and right-moving fermions. The SO4 R-symmetric group can be broken into SU2 left and SU2 right. The left-moving fermions have equal angular momenta on the two circles which can be put in SO4. The Ramon-Ramon vacua of this system. So when you have no P, when you only have D1 and D5, then you can have both left-moving and right-moving fermions, and then the angular momentum of those vacua is limited, is bounded by the product of N1 times N5. And it can be either left-moving or right-moving any way you want. Now, and you have 8 superchargers because you have a D1-D5 system. And the entropy of this system was basically found to be square root of N1 N5 minus J, where J is the angular momentum. So if you have N1 N5 equals to J, there's only one configuration which matured mapped to the maximally spinning supertube. If J is less, you can actually also have like some wiggly tubes. So actually you can count the entropy to see that you have the entropy increases if J becomes less than N1 N5. This entropy has been computed both by the in the FP system by Matur. Don and Belkis also computed it in the using the Born-Infeld action of the supertubes, and Per Krauss and Masaki Shigemori at UCLA, they have an open string calculation which also has the same result. So you can count this entropy. There are three ways of doing it, and you get the same thing. Now, if you add momentum in order to be BPS, you must have purely left-moving fermions. So you must, you cannot excite momentum modes in both left-moving and right-moving because you break supersymmetry. And if the number of momentum units is bigger than N1 N5, the angular momentum has been argued to be bounded by those numbers. So J squared is less than N1 times N5 times NP. And moreover, the angular momentum on the two spheres must be the same. So J23 must be equal to J45. And for NP much bigger than N1 N5, this has been mapped to the Breckenridge Myers Pitten Waffa black hole, so which is just a spinning D95P black hole. And this system has the entropy again equal to the N1 N5 NP minus J squared. So if J squared is equal to this, you have a black again have zero entropy. In both cases, if J is bigger than N1 N5 here, or if J is bigger than this, you get closed time-like curves in the solution. So there exists an upper bound on the J, and if you spin it more, then actually the black hole develops closed time-like curves. And the same, the supertube also, if you put more J than this, it develops closed time-like curves. Now, the tubes, on the other hand, as I explained, so the angular momentum is actually given by N1 N5, so they actually have the same features as the D1D5 system, and the angular momentum can be you can just put it in one plane and you can put zero on the other plane, so the tubes can have angular momentum in any way you want. Now, if you put higher dipole moments, for example, if you put this is the angular momentum of a tube with one with dipole charge equals to one. If you put dipole charge equals to something, I mean to number d, then basically the angular momentum lowers because the tube becomes sinks in, so the radius is going to be the radius is going to be smaller. So if you look at a circular tube which has N1 and N5 charges and dipole charge, N1 and N5 total charges and dipole charge d is going to have j equals the product of those over d. And the radius, as I argued before, again for a circular tube, is going to be r squared equals g string times n1 n5 over d squared. That's for a two-charge tube. A three-charge tube also has the same feature, the same j, but in the r squared, there's another fraction of the third of the other charges. Now, if the three charges are going to be equal, which is what I'll assume for now, then I mean the R cube is just going to be of the order of this J squared over over N squared. No, I mean and I'll just use those tubes as probes of the black hole. I mean, of course, one can make a very intricate argument, but I mean a very intricate examples. But I think this is the most relevant for the physics. I mean, just take the three charges to be equal and see what is happening. Now, if you take the BMPV black hole and you compute the proper length of the horizon circumference, So if you actually take a circle around the horizon, it's non-spherical, but you can compute the proper length of the horizon circumference along one of the equator planes. And the radius of the BMPV black hole is actually given by r squared equals g string times n cubed minus j squared over n squared. So you can see that this is the same as this. So if J is very, very large, then actually the radius of the tube is going to be huge, much, much bigger than the radius of the black hole. If J is smaller, then the tube is going to fit inside the black hole. And yes, so I actually choose, of course you can choose some direction on which the radius is going to be smaller, but you can actually choose one of the equator planes, so one of the planes in which there's angular momentum, like the 2-3 plane in this case. So I'm computing the radius in the 2-3 plane, which is given by this. Because the tubes also have angular momentum in the 2-3 plane in the 4-5 plane, so the tubes in a way are extended in the 2-3 plane more than in the other planes, and in the 4-5 plane more than in the other planes. So I'm using a tube which is, let's say, in the 2-3 plane, and that tube has zero size in the other direction. So, I think it's more natural to compare that direction because the angular momenta are in the same. The tube angular momentum and the black hole angular momentum are in the same, and one of the black hole angular momenta are in the same direction. So that's actually why I'm comparing that particular radius and not some diagonal thing. The diagonal radius might be smaller. I totally agree. So the BMPV again. So as you can see from here, if the tube fits inside the BMPV, then J of the tube must be less than n cubed. And if the tube doesn't fit inside the BMPV, then J of the tube must be bigger than J of the tube must be bigger than n to the 3/2. So there are two types of tubes. Some of them, which have J bigger than n to the 3/2, those have more angular momentum than the black hole can carry, and those are going to be outside of the black hole. And you have the tubes which have J of the order of the angular momentum which the black hole can carry, and those are going to be inside this horizon area. So if somebody gives us a black hole which has a certain J, I can say, let's look at the tubes. I'll have tubes which have more J, but they have bigger sizes, and I have tubes which have less J and they have smaller sizes. But the tubes which are supposed to be the hair of this black hole, which are the tubes which have the same J as the black hole, are going to have the size of the same order as the horizon size. So that's also quite a non.
Black hole zero.
Sorry.
If
the black hole has zero angular momentum, then okay. So those are circular tubes. If the black hole has zero angular momentum, I can always cook up some tubes which have. So a circular tube has zero size if it has zero angular momentum. But I can take a tube which has this shape. Again, this is non-intersecting because I have four transverse directions. This tube is going to have zero angular momentum because I have some angular momentum here and some here. So here it goes out and here it goes in the plane. So this tube will have no net angular momentum, and yet it's going to be able. So this tube should be one of the microstates of the black hole with no angular momentum.
What fixes the size of that tube?
Sorry?
What fixes the characteristic size of that tube?
Anything you want. I can take any squiggly curve such that some integrals are going to be equal to zero. Sorry? No, if you can have a tube which has the same angular momentum as the black hole, which is much, much bigger. So if I can show that there's a huge number of geometries which have the same angular momentum as the black hole and are much bigger than the black hole horizon, and those geometries differ from each other at a place which is much bigger than the black hole horizon, asymptotically bigger, then there's no way for Matur's conjecture to be right. Matur's conjecture is that basically those microgeometries differ from each other at the point where the horizon is. Away from that point, all the geometries are identical, and you can just have the geometry is identical to the black hole geometry. So if I can have some cubes which have the same J as the black hole, so if I can have some microgeometries which have the same J as the black hole, and are nevertheless I have quite a lot of them, and they differ from each other at some very, very large place away from the horizon, then this proves Matur's conjecture. So yes.
Can I just clarify? When you talk about these geometries being the same outside of some horizon,
yes,
differing only inside.
Mm-hmm.
They're not exactly the same.
So no, they have some public.
Sure. Power law fall off, like mm-hmm. you would expect, just for different multiple moments.
I think so. Yes.
So they have the same sort of
charges. Yes.
In mass. Mm-hmm. But they differ as much as possible otherwise.
Fair enough, yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm. In the same way, the in the CFT you have the same features. So I mean, you have like those, and the microsets of the CFT also have the, they have the same charges, but they have different verbs of different fields. So the falloffs, I mean, in the ADS CFT language, those falloffs are just going to be different verbs of different operators in the CFT, and those verbs actually index the microstates.
If the geometries differ by power law falloffs, how does one get a characteristic size? Say that, well,
the correct,
same
this size, the only size I have here is just the size. I mean, I don't have the geometry yet. I only have the Born info description of the cube, and I have its behavior at large. I have some G. I know it's BPS, and I have some formula. So I only know that the Born info description of the cube gives me a certain size. That's the only. Sorry, the Born info description. This is not the gravity. This is the formula that just comes from the pure Born info description of the cube. So I'm not comparing gravity and gravity. I have to find the solutions first. I mean, for all of those guys and so on and so forth, I haven't done that. I only have the Born info description of the tubes, which is easy to find, as you saw. And this gives me a certain size. And basically, the size fits in well with the BMPV size. That's the only statement that I'm making. So it's not. I don't have the full geometry. I don't have all the decaying modes and so on and so forth. And I actually don't know what it means to have geometries different from each other. I mean, I don't have. There's no rule to do that. I mean, that's something which. So, again. On the other hand, I know that this formula, at least in the two-charge case, this formula exists also. I mean, so the two-charge, in the two-charge case, the solution is known. And there I know that the size of the geometry is actually, of the Born info. So the Born info formula for the size is actually preserved in the two-charge case, where I do know the geometry. So in the three-charge case, I can also assume that since I have supersymmetry, the same will happen. I mean, it's an assumption. It's not. So I'm comparing this Born info formula with a gravity formula, but I think I'm pretty sure that this is going to hold in for the solutions as well. So again, if this size were, I mean, if for the same J I would have had some supertubes which are huge, much much bigger than the black hole horizon, then Matur's proposal would have been incorrect, because part of his proposal is that those geometries are the same in a certain up to a certain point, and then they start differing from each other in this horizon region. I mean, that's actually one of the crucial.
Mm-hmm. If you happen to choose NQ to be close to J squared, your formula does say
Qs
are much bigger than
those formulas. I mean, that's like some numbers here and some numbers here. So,
But I can tune the second formula to be essentially zero, can't I?
You can tune the second formula to be here. No, that's right. What do you want to say? I'm sorry, I kind of. No, I think, when J squared equals N cubed, then the horizon actually is zero. So, I mean, defining a size is not very well. I mean, I think I'm just, I mean, you can define a size, but I mean, it's not, I mean, you cannot talk about fitting the something inside a certain size. I mean, of course, there's no proper definition of the size of the black hole, because the horizon is zero size. I mean, you cannot define.
No, but you could just take N cubed minus J squared small, but not zero. You could have to cancel the mm-hmm. J squared.
Mm-hmm. So then you say that the tube radius is bigger for the same.
Well, would you just say that those configurations don't contribute?
Yeah, maybe those. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think there's a way out, but it just means that this is not such a strong check of the proposal. Because you just include mm-hmm. the configurations which are small.
Mm-hmm. Sure, but for example, I mean, if I would have obtained some formula here which didn't have an n cubed but only had an n. J squared over n, for example. I mean, suppose I did some other calculation, and I mean, if I didn't have this power of n cubed, then all the tubes would have not. I mean, for a generic black hole, which doesn't. I mean, which has those things comparable, but not in the same, but not exactly canceling each other. So I mean, for a solution with no small parameters, most of the tubes would have laid outside of this radius. So, I mean, those formulas have the same scaling, which I think is quite.
If this is for circular tubes. As you were saying, mm-hmm. and then if you get away from mm-hmm. circular, you don't have any real.
Mm-hmm. No, sure, but we can have like a tube like this and another tube like this, which have the same, which have equal J's. I mean, I agree. I mean, so the point is, I mean, some of, I mean, I didn't show, I mean, of course, one needs to like take all the tubes and, I mean, count all of them and so on and so forth. I mean, but this is just an estimate for the size of a tube. I mean, the other tubes are going to, I mean, to get a big J like this, you need to be to have quite a large size, quite a large radius. I mean, that's the point that I made. Okay, let me go. Now, there's another. When did I start? How much do I have? Not too much. Okay. I think I should. I'll just do this very fast, and then I'll just go through I'll just go to the solution, which I'll probably cover. I started like 35 past, so.
I've taken up at least 5 or 10 minutes of your time.
Okay. Okay. So actually, let's do some ADS-CFT, and let's look at some cubes which have NP bigger than N1 and 5. So I'm just looking at some range when the momentum units, I mean NP is smaller than N1 and 5. Then the BMPV black hole is going to be equal to square root of NP times N1 times N5, the angular momentum of the BMPV black hole, and which is going to be smaller than this number. On the other hand, in the CFT, we know that we can have states which have angular momentum up to J1, up to N1 and 5. So in the CFT, we have some states which are actually dual to something which is not in the BMPV black hole. So if you look in the if you go into this parameter range, the CFT has states with J up to N1 and 5. The BMPV black hole, on the other hand, can only take that much angular momentum. It cannot be it cannot spin more than that. So the question is, what do we do with those states? What do we do with the states which have J bigger than the J of the BMPV? Now, according to this picture, they actually dual to some supertube geometries. So for J bigger than J BMPV, we still have the supertubes, which can take more angular momentum than the BMPV can. So those and also in the small p limit. So if I take n to be, p to be very very small, then also Matur claims that Matur did a perturbative calculation in p, and he also matched the CFT states 1-to-1 with some geometries which have one unit of momentum. So I'll have for some j, for j bigger than the j of the BMPV, each CFT state will correspond to one geometry. So it'll be like a one geometry per microstate point. Now, for a smaller j than this, all of a sudden the BMPV black hole will appear, and I'll have the BMPV black hole describing the ensemble of the other states. That's the old way of thinking about things. I mean, that's actually what the old way of thinking about things implies. The fact that you have some BMPV black hole for some J's, and then there's nothing else. Beyond that angular momentum, all the CFT states are described by geometries. And I think the distinction between CFT states mapped to the black hole and CFT states mapped to geometries containing supertubes is quite arbitrary. There's no proper way to define this distinction. So I think it's much more likely. At least from this comparison, it looks like. It's much more likely that all the CFT states are going to be mapped to some geometries. That's an argument which also. It's not a very solid argument, but it might happen like that. But again, it's very arbitrary to say that some CFT states are mapped to geometries and to supertubes, and then some others are mapped to the black hole. And there's like this. There's this distinction. So, again, that's another.
There are two basic things you can do in the CFT, right?
Sorry?
There are two basic things you can do in the CFT. One is to excite open strings, and the other is to play with the zero modes of the
five. Yes, but the black hole, for example, can describe some things which are only which have the zero modes excited also. I think the black hole, as I'll show, I can take some supertube and throw it into a black hole. I'll still have a black hole, hopefully. And that's going to have the zero modes excited also. So, I agree there are two things, but somehow, I still think there's a bit of a distinction here. As a side effect of this, if the black hole can be thought as the average of geometries which has J less than BMPV, one can ask if there's another object which has J more than J BMPV, which would basically probably be a black ring, which can give you the statistical average of the supertube geometries in the same way in which, if the Matur conjecture is right, then the black hole is described by some geometries with J less than J BMPV, and the geometries which have J bigger than J BMPV, if you average them or statistical average or whatever you do with them, they should form some black object whose entropy should give you the number of those. So the entropy of this black object should give you the number of those large J configurations. So based on this, actually, Per Krause and I proposed in our paper that there should be like a BPS black ring in this theory, which has J bigger than the G of the BMPV black hole. And we conjecture that, I mean, we just say that it might be there. I mean, it's one of the configurations. If Matur's conjecture is right, it's possible that, I mean, there should be something which describes the average of those microstates which have J bigger than J BMPV, and that's the natural thing to expect is to have a black ring. Now, let's actually look for those solutions. I mean, that's the second part of the talk. I hope I'm not going to do it. So, to find the solutions, actually, it's possible to find. I mean, finding the solutions is quite hard. I mean, Matur tried to boost Kaluza-Kai monopoles. It's usually a bad idea. I know Henriette and Roberto Emparan tried to find it. I mean, it's a rather hard business. I think the point is, if you just take normal solutions and to just dualize them and do things with them, it doesn't work. I mean, I think you need to have some more powerful tools. And we used some methods which were developed by Nick Warner and Nemeshansky and Pilch and company, basically the group from USC. And those methods actually involve using killing spinners. And we know that the supertubes preserve the same supersymmetry as their components. So you actually have to use the killing spinners and the equations of motion to actually find the form of the metric. So you go back, I mean, you basically have to use, so you start from the killing spinners and then you basically find the equations which and first of all, the differential relations between the different forms and the different, and the metric coefficients. And basically the whole problem, at least for the flat supertube, the whole problem basically can be solved quite easily, as you'll see. The method is very powerful. I mean, it can be used to like much more complicated setups. I mean, this is just, it's like crunching nuts. I mean, it's very easy to use. And basically we'll find that, and what we'll do here, we'll actually find the metric of the three charge and three dipole charge supertube, and also find that find some evidence that a black ring actually does exist. So the way to do this is actually to t-dualize this setup, d0, d4, f1, twice to get d2, d2, and f1, and then lift to M theory. So if you do that, the dipole charges, they all become a fibrin charge in M theory. And if you look in the flat supertube limit, you just have M2 dipole charges in the 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 plane, and you'll have M2 charges, and then you'll have M5 dipole charges in the other directions. Now, the dipole charges are going to be charges in this limit because, I mean, you go very close to the supertube, so they just appear to be normal charges. And there's a metric concept which is actually very easy to show that this is the more generic metric concept which you can take. Just the superposition of three M2 brains in different planes. There are the C fields are the same. The fact that you have an M5 brain charge sitting around is basically embedded by the fact that those are the dipole charges. So if you integrate along the tube on the three sphere, you get those three dipole charges. And on top of that, there's like this extra animal, which I call T, which cannot be rolled out by symmetry. So it must be, I mean, it could be there. So I just put it in the ansatz. And basically, if you use the fact that the killing spinners satisfy the same, have the same projectors as the killing spinners of the M2 brains, this gives you automatically three equations for the Willebinds. And an equation for the angular momentum. There's a plus sign here, but Henriette told me it's a minus sign, and I think she's right. So people are actually, I mean, there's... and if you use those equations and you plug them into the equation of motion, you actually find that the harmonic functions, which are basically e to the 6a, satisfy these relations, d2, dz2. So I assumed, again, that you have some sources which are spread along a line. They might have an arbitrary dependence on the z direction, the direction along the tube, but they're not. But the tube is aligned. So I have an S2 around this. I mean, I have a SO3 invariance. So I have dz2, and you can actually stare at this for a moment, and you can see that this is exactly the harmonic operator in four dimensions. The only non-trivial part is that the right-hand side of this is not zero when you have three dipole charges. The right-hand side of this has the dipole charges entering through this combination. So in the Lunimalda-Sanamaos paper, where they studied two-charge supertubes, D2 and D3 were equal to zero, so all the three right-hand sides were equal to zero, and because of that, you just had harmonic functions in R4, and it was very easy to write the general supertube solution by just superposing some harmonic I mean, by just superposing some harmonic functions. When you have more than one dipole charge, when you have two dipole charges or three dipole charges, those harmonic functions actually have a non-trivial source. And because of that, actually, it's very hard to write. I mean, you cannot just take a superposition of harmonic functions. I mean, it's not going to work because you have this non-trivial right-hand sides. So actually, this explains why it has been so hard to get those supertube solutions until now. I mean, people. I mean, just because of this extra right-hand side terms.
And still linear
equations. They are linear equations, but the D's are. Okay, so the D's are, so I mean, those solutions are easy to solve, I mean, if you have a flat supertube. Now, if you have a curved supertube, the problem is that those guys are going to depend on the angle around the tube. So this is going to become highly, this is going to get messy. So, I mean, here they're just numbers, but they're going to, so those D's are going to depend on the shape of the tube. So I think that's actually the main, so it doesn't, so just a harmonic function sourced by the place where the tube is not going to be enough to solve the equations. So the solutions are actually very easy to find. If you assume the things are independent of Z, the harmonic functions are just Z1, Z2, and Z3. And basically you have, this is blowing my transparency away. So basically you have these three harmonic functions. The angular momentum is given by this combination. GZ, you probably noticed two transparencies away that there was a non-trivial G Wilbein for the TZ components. So E1 is proportional to DZ here. So this factor of K actually enters in the GZZ metric. So if you actually, if you require the tube not to have any closed time-like curves, GZZ must be bigger than 0. And if K is bigger than this product of the three Z's, then you actually do have closed time-like curves. Now, the tube which Per and I had, which has two dipole charges, just D2 and D3, and D1 is equal to 0, the Z's are going to be are given by this Z1 is basically, the leading terms are basically this and this. So the absence of closed time-like curves implies that D2 Q2 plus D3 Q3 squared is less than this, which is actually a geometric inequality. So, basically, this is only satisfied when Q3 D3 equals Q2 D2. So, this is actually the Born-Infeld relation between the dipole charges, and you see that here it comes out from the requirement that the background has no closed time-like curves. So, I think that's a nice confirmation that things are indeed coming up in a nice fashion. Now, if you want to have three charges and three dipole charges, the metric is basically given by near the tube is given basically given by this combination where C is a function of the three charges and of the three dipoles and the three charges. If C is equal to 0, then the metric near the tube is just ADS 3 from DR and DT DZ cross S2 cross some cross a line cross so it's just ADS 3 cross S2 cross T6 and again, it has four supercharges, and so that's one. And the curvature is very small near the center. So the metric is actually smooth and has no horizons and so on and so forth. If C is bigger than 0, then there's actually a horizon. I mean, this supertube has a horizon of non-zero size. I mean, you can basically multiply dz squared with d theta squared and d phi squared, which are the directions along the tube. And around the tube and along, and the horizon is proportional to just this, the square root of this. The horizon area is proportional to the square root of this combination. So what we discovered, actually, this is going to be the near tube metric. So for C equals to 0, the horizon area is 0, and the metric is has this form, and we believe this is actually the supertube. This is going to be the feature supertube metric. And if C is bigger than 0, then you have a non-zero horizon area. And this is actually the metric of the three charge of the black ring in the large radius limit. So that's, so I mean, we did find an object which has three charges and which has a large radius, and which in the large radius limit has a non-zero horizon. So we did conjecture it using the Matur proposal, actually. I mean, that's how we just threw the idea in the air. I mean, we didn't know exactly it's going to be there. And then we actually found this object which has the right, which has an area which has the right features to be a black ring area, and there's one more. So this is actually I'm basically finished. So there's one more thing which I want to show. So if you look at the, so let's imagine increasing Q past this D. As I showed you, the horizon area is proportional to square root of the horizon area is proportional to Q squared times D squared minus 16 D to the fourth, when all the dipole charges are going to be equal. So let's imagine starting with a straight cube, which has Q equals 4D. And basically, so then there's only one object like that. It's just a straight cube. And basically, the entropy is going to be 0. If Q is less than 4D, then there's no regular geometry. There are closed timeline curves in the geometry. If Q is more than 4D, then actually you can take this cube. As I showed you, you can actually make also the tube wiggly. So if Q is bigger than 4D, you can take a wiggly tube, for example, which has more. So the charge density is proportional to the, so Q is proportional to the length. So basically, Q is proportional to how big this tube is. And D, on the other hand, is just proportional to the length of this interval, because the dipole charge, let's say, here and here cancels. So if you put Q bigger than 4D, then all of a sudden you can make the tubes wiggly. And you have a whole bunch of configurations which can be there. And in the same time, when Q is bigger than 4D, the black ring appears. So here I have a configuration when, for some parameter, Q equals to 4D, you only have a straight tube, and you have no multiplicity, and you have no black hole. You increase this parameter a tiny bit, the black ring appears, and the number of these tubes can become larger. So you have actually the number which goes from 0 up, and you have the horizon which also goes from 0 up. So we believe this is actually quite a nice place to actually count this, to count the microstates. So basically, in this configuration, one can actually count how many wiggly tubes one has. And basically, the counting, if it gives the black ring entropy, then this is actually the first confirmation that you have a macroscopic object which has Matur's features. I mean, this is a macroscopic black ring which does have, which can actually be thought as, I mean, the microstates just give the right count. And if it doesn't match, then Matur's thing is wrong. So here we have like this lab where one can actually do the counting and actually count how many wiggly tubes one has, and just see immediately, it's a few months work, see actually if this is true or not. So again, the counting can be done using the Born-Infeld action. Unfortunately, here we have three charges, so it doesn't work. Three dipole charges, so we have an S5 charge, so it doesn't work. One can do an open string calculation, as Perkraus and Masaki did. Again, it doesn't work because of the NS5 charge. Hopefully, one can count in geometry, or one can count using a closed string picture. And basically, Don and Radu and Berkis and Harriet were trying to push things in that direction. I don't know how successful we'll be, but we're definitely, it's something which we are looking at, and I think it has a potential of proving or disproving this picture. And if this picture is right, again, I think it will change quite a lot our understanding of what black holes are. So that's the conclusion. I mean, I guess you all know. And sorry for taking so much time. Yes?
Mm-hmm. You have these super tubes with
yes.
A lot of angular momentum, mm-hmm. and presumably you can roll off them to a lot of angular momentum, mm-hmm. so they should be a black hole. I don't see how that relies at all on the notion of there being a classical geometry associated with each of those solutions. What you said is you have a lot of microstates, mm-hmm. if you expect a black hole. But Matteo's idea is saying more than that. He's saying each of those microstates also have a classical geometry.
So actually, that's a very good point. It's possible to actually count. So it depends actually what you count. If you count solutions of string theory, then if you take a non-abelian, if you assume you have some tubes which is a very highly wrapped, for example, and you have some non-abelian configuration of the fields on that tube, do you call that a smooth geometry or not? No. So from a GR point of view, that's not a resolution of. But on the other hand, there's a string background. This makes perfect sense, and it's a different string background than some other non-abelian configuration on those d-brains. So you do have two string backgrounds, which are macroscopically large, and they are smooth, and they have different. I mean, if you do scattering in them, you'll have different results. Their geometry is the same, but they have different.
The Matteo's slightly contentious feature in the Matteo's mm-hmm. specific proposal is that everything can be regarded as purely geometric.
That's actually hard to make to ascertain right now. I mean, I think on the other hand, if we can do the calculation in the black, I mean, in this black ring regime, when we actually do have the geometries and we do have the
geometry.
Sorry?
You have something that's more like the geometry of the black hole, not the geometry of the microstates.
No, the geometries of the, yes, the microstates are just going to be those wiggly tubes.
We don't have them,
but you can do them perturbatively, because you have a place where there are no geometries, there are no microstates, which is basically the straight tube.
Yeah, that's more like Mercier's naive E1D5 metric. It starts from...
No, this has three charges.
It replaces his naive metric by the regular metric, and I think this is
exactly... No. This is a good metric. This is smooth. No, this is smooth. This is like complete...
When you periodically identify...
Sorry?
When you periodically identify a tube, that will not be smooth any longer. That won't be a regular horizon. Sorry, there will be a singularity in the interior when you identify that.
The Matur solutions have the same... The two charge supertube solutions have the same features.
The naive ones do. Mm-hmm.
I agree that, I mean, so probably the point of, would,
so to,
yes.
To translate, mm-hmm. the current hope is that if we transform to a smarter duality for it, which things tend to become regular, Yost's solutions might actually be smart.
Well, that doesn't work for the living resistance. Then they have to check their experience.
That is correct.
The problem is, like, when you replace that, it's like going from Poincaré coordinates, from Poincaré ADS to global ADS. So you actually change what time at infinity is. I know what Matur is. I mean, Matur is basically replacing the geometry near this. I mean, if you identify again, I mean, as Harvey said, I mean, you get problems. So Matur is replacing this by, I mean, his replacement is basically by I mean, his replacement is almost the same, is in the same spirit as one does in going from Poincaré ADS to global ADS. I mean, you basically have some brains which have some sources at a certain place, and you just replace that by some other asymptotically ADS region. And so I think Matur's replacement is in the same spirit. On the other hand, this replacement messes up the time at infinity. I mean, if you do that replacement, I mean, you change the notion of time. I mean, you change from time going like this to time going like this. Now, the black hole, on the other hand, the black ring also, so if you assume some time at infinity, which, then I mean, the black ring exists in those coordinates. So the black ring does exist in the coordinates when you have straight tubes and wiggly tubes without doing the Matur. Without doing the Matur replacement. So I think it's possible, I mean, I think it might be possible to count here without doing any of the Matur. I mean, it might be again, I mean.
Well, not as a creative party. In order to make him slightly happier, one might point out that one took the smooth two-chart solutions, the nice ones, and if one dualizes that into his N3 frame, I don't know if anyone here has actually done this calculation, but one expects that in fact one gets a singular metric. Maybe that Yost is still alone and clever game, and N3 brain by undoing this comes out nicely.
The singularity
is a simple as this.
Yeah, pretty much is, because it turns
includes
a fine
model.
Into a D brain, into an
N5
brain. What do you mean there's nothing arbitrary? So, I mean, in 2B, I think those things are better behaved, I mean, if you dualize them to type 2B, because, I mean, in 2B, the biggest brain is a Kolodziejczyk monopoles, and usually the metric tends to be nice and smooth and to cap off. I mean, in other duality frames, I mean, you have some D-brains, and then the metric near the D-brains can get messy, so I think, I mean...
I think what you've done is you've provided interesting evidence that BPS black rings are not exist, but I'm not sure that I've regarded it as things in favor of concerns.
It might. I mean, again, I mean, I don't think I have evidence to prove. I mean, I don't think one can prove Matur's place. I think this is just a good lab to start. I mean, if one can do a calculation here and count those tubes and match with the black ring, I mean, there's a black ring entropy which I gave, and one can do a counting. And if the counting matches, I think, I mean, it's basically the same calculation which Don and Belkis did for the picture. Yes, I mean, so this gravity solution doesn't have horizon. This gravity solution doesn't. I mean, so you can find the wiggly tubes perturbative on top of the straight tube. That's the so the spirit of our calculation is actually to find the perturbation to perturb the solution and to find how many modes one has and basically to count the entropy.
Yeah, but
It's not, I mean, you don't have to find the full solution. I mean, just enough to do perturbations and to see that they start rising in the same way. I mean, the entropy of the black hole basically starts from zero and goes up. And you just have to match the way they start from zero. You don't have to match the full number with the full number.
Well, except when the black ring is just infinitesimally away from extremality, mm-hmm. the curvature of the horizon is enormous.
No. Curvature is always tiny.
The curvature is always tiny.
It's always 1 over some big number. So the curvatures are always tiny. The near horizon metric is always ADS3 cross some S2 cross some
S1. Is very small.
Sorry?
When the area is tiny,
yes. The area can be zero.
Finite size S2 cross infinitesimal S1. So the curvature has to be.
So, I don't know, I think it's a good place to do a calculation and to show things.
Good.